ever to offer. I do not pretend to enlighten the reader. I pretend only to give a fillip to his memory, and I hold any writer sufficiently justified who is himself in love with his theme. 1. Mr. Ruskin has given it up, that is very true, but only after extracting half a lifetime of pleasure and an immeasurable quantity of fame from it. We all may do the same after it has served our turn, which it probably will not cease to do for many a year to come. Meantime, it is Mr. Ruskin who, beyond anyone, helps us to enjoy it. He has indeed lately produced several aids to depression in the shape of certain little ill-humorous pamphlets, the series of St. Mark's Rest, which embody his latest reflections on the subject of our city and describe the latest atrocities perpetrated there. These latter are numerous and deeply to be deplored, but to admit that they have spoiled Venice would be to admit that Venice may be spoiled, an admission pregnant, as it seems to us, with disloyalty. Fortunately, one reacts against the Ruskinian contagion, and 1 hour of the lagoon is worth 100 pages of demoralized prose. This queer late-coming prose of Mr. Ruskin, including the revised and condensed issue of The Stones of Venice, only one little volume of which has been published, or perhaps ever will be, is all to be read, though much of it appears addressed to children of a tender age. It is pitched in the nursery key, and might be supposed to emanate from an angry governess. It is, however, all suggestive, and much of it is delightfully just. There is an inconceivable want of form in it, though the author has spent his life in laying down the principles of form and scolding people for departing from them. But it throbs and flashes with the love of his subject, a love disconcerted and abjured, but which has still much of the force of inspiration. Among the many strange things that have befallen Venice, she has had the good fortune to become the object of passion to a man of splendid genius who has made her his own, and in doing so has made her the world's. There is no better reading at Venice, therefore, as I say, than Ruskin, for every true Venice lover can separate the wheat from the chaff. The narrow theological spirit, the moralism à tout propos, the queer provincialities and pruderies are mere wild weeds in a mountain of flowers. One may doubtless be very happy in Venice without reading at all, without criticizing or analyzing or thinking a strenuous thought. It is a city in which I suspect there is very little strenuous thinking, and yet it is a city in which there must be almost as much happiness as misery. The misery of Venice stands there for all the world to see. It is part of the spectacle. A thoroughgoing devotee of local colour might consistently say it is part of the pleasure. The Venetian people have little to call their own, little more than the bare privilege of leading their lives in the most beautiful of towns. Their habitations are decayed, their taxes heavy, their pockets light, their opportunities few. One receives an impression, however, that life presents itself to them with attractions not accounted for in this meagre train of advantages, and that they are on better terms with it than many people who have made a better bargain. They lie in the sunshine, they dabble in the sea, they wear bright rags. They fall into attitudes and harmonies. They assist at an eternal conversazione. It is not easy to say that one would have them other than they are, and it certainly would make an immense difference should they be better fed. The number of persons in Venice who evidently never have enough to eat is painfully large, but it will be more painful if we did not equally perceive that the rich Venetian temperament may bloom upon a dog's allowance. Nature